Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. I want to introduce myself. My name is Jeff Thomas with the consulting firm Jones & Stokes, and we are writing the environmental impact report for the Central Coast MPA project on behalf of Paul. And in the back we have Marisa Adams. Marisa's assisting you as you all arrive. She's also with Jones & Stokes. And then we have Debbie, our court reporter, is providing some documentation for us so we can record all your comments. So, not a good meeting unless there's a technical difficulty, and that was an easy one. So, again, I want to thank you guys for coming this afternoon. It's really important to get your feedback on this process, and I know many of you probably and we're going to start with a brief presentation, give you just a little bit of a project overview. Most of you are probably really familiar with the details of the project and have been involved in the process for quite a while. I'm going to talk, Paul's going to speak a little bit about the project. I'm going to talk more about the CEQA process and how you can participate in that and kind of what our timeline is. And then we're going to roll into getting your comments. Just so you know, in case you haven't already filled out a comment card, if you want to speak, you can fill out a card and Marisa will get those up to me later and we'll be able to call you up. If you want to leave written comments, you can also do that, and you can also provide comments after this meeting as well. And this is one of two scoping meetings that we're having. We have a second meeting tomorrow evening from 6:30 to 8:30 in Monterey. Actually, before I proceed, just in case people do have other priorities and want to make sure they know what our goal is today, I'll just start with that. We're here to get comments on inputs into the environmental document that analyzes impacts of the project. And just so you know, we aren't making any recommendations as a result of that or making any decisions. That's really up for the Fish and Game Commission. Many of you are probably aware there's some references on packages, alternatives, things like that. You can provide those. We have a separate comment form that Paul will make available. If you want to provide those, they'll go directly to the commission. But today we're really focused on the environmental review document, and we're not making decisions about how we lay this project out. So I just want to make sure you guys were aware of that up front. And we'll talk a little bit more about the CEQA process in just a minute.
Okay, thank you, Jeff. Any of you will know what I'm going to cover in the next 5 minutes if you've been following the process, so this will be background. But for those of you who don't, there are several pieces of legislation that are either directly or indirectly, and it does consider the use of marine protected areas, which is the major link to the next piece of legislation, which is why we are here. This is the Marine Protection Act, 1999, and we've been going through this process, several starts and stops, as some of you know, since then, and it requires a master plan for MPAs and the Fish and Game Commission to adopt a program for new protected areas. And thirdly, a less familiar piece of legislation to you is the Marine Managed Areas Improvement Act, which actually created a simplified classification system for marine protected areas and other marine managed areas, and I will briefly explain those three types in a few minutes. So there are six goals of the Marine Protection Act, which those of you who follow the process are probably nauseous from hearing them so many times. So I'm not going to go over them. We'll just briefly, these are paraphrased, about protecting diversity, conserving, rebuilding populations of marine life, improving days are based on science and ensure they are designed and managed as a network. So the initiative process, some of the major highlights that have occurred in the past year. A year ago, the Commission adopted what we call the Master Plan Framework, and this is the blueprint or the guideline for how we are going about this process and other regional processes in working towards a network of MPAs throughout the coast. We have some outside funding sources, which many of you are aware about, which we have also recommendations for how to continue funding for the MPA processes, which came out as a document in December 2005. And then we have the proposals for the MPA networks, which you see behind you on those maps, which were developed through an intensive stakeholder process. And a document in process that relates to coordination of state and federal agencies dealing with ocean management on marine protected area issues. And for the MPA process for the Central Coast, as most of you know now, we have four proposals that have been submitted to the Commission. Packages 1, 2R, and 3R came from the stakeholder process. 3R was recommended as a preferred alternative by the Blue Ribbon Task Force. The Department has modified Package 3R in several ways, and we call that Package P. That was presented to the Commission as a preferred alternative at their recent meeting. And those four packages are all being considered by the Commission. That was what the first meeting was all about last week for the this one-page form. It's mostly blank, but it says comments for the Fishing Commission about the MLPA process. If you can't make it to the Morro Bay meeting, I'm sorry, to the Monterey Bay meeting next week on Tuesday, August 15th, if you'd like to fill out something in your comments, I will personally see that they get to the Commission. I will make copies of them, and either I or John Ewitz will distribute them to the commissioners on the 15th in Monterey. And so that's, if you, and also if you can't attend, you can also watch it on the webcast as well. Again, the packages have different types and again, shows you the three basic types that we're working with. A reserve, of course, is no take, about world-class scientific collecting. State Marine Park is no commercial take, but it may allow recreational take. And the State Marine Conservation Area may allow some types of commercial and or recreational take. So now I'll give it back to Jeff, and this is your website address, if you can find a lot of information there. And also, if you have any comments, you can email them to us. And I'll give you that at the end of the show, but show, it's more on the show. Excuse me. Anyway, I'll pass this out while Jeff is talking, and then we'll continue on with why we are here today. Thank you.
Those who may be a little less familiar, CEQA is the California Environmental Quality Act, and it is primarily a process of disclosure. It looks at environmental effects of a proposed action, in this case the MPA project, and evaluates those and provides analysis on potential both adverse and beneficial effects. They could be less than significant, they could be significant, they could be something that's mitigated. In this case, we're looking at preparing environmental impact report on behalf of Fish and Game. The document doesn't make recommendations to the Commission. It simply presents the information for their review and their consideration and their decision. Pretty large distribution. There'll be a draft environmental impact report that we'll prepare that'll get circulated and be available to you to review and comment on. And then we'll prepare a final document that incorporates your feedback, provides responses to comments, and may or may not have some changes that result from your feedback that are incorporated in the document. And then it's given to the Commission to consider and potentially certify along with mitigation monitoring or program for any mitigation measures that may need to be incorporated into the project. So in preparing the EIR, we're going to look at a number of potential impact areas, and it includes these. Aesthetics, or what we'd consider visual quality, effects to agricultural resources, air quality, bioresources, cultural resources, hydrology, land use, public services, recreation, etc. And not every one of these subject areas has to actually, it isn't always relevant to the project. So some of these may seem a little bit out of place for what the project is. And we will probably have a chapter that addresses impact areas that are dismissed and why. And so it'll be made clear that, you know, what are the things that we're focusing on of this list. And then the other thing the EIR does is it provides a cumulative analysis that considers the project in relationship to other either existing or pending future near-term projects, and what are the cumulative effects of those. Are there growth inducement impacts? It also looks at alternatives, in this case the packages that which is simply based on the criteria of potential impacts, which project alternative has the least environmental effect in terms of impact. And that's really the only recommendation that it makes. So the scoping meeting, this is really an early opportunity to get your feedback and government agency feedback on what should be in this environmental impact report. And we look at a whole slew of things. These are kind of the things that are the focus of today's meeting and what we're looking for comments on. What are some of the important environmental issues? A lot of information to us, but maybe there's something else that's relevant that we should be considering. Any input on how the existing environment is characterized? This is where scoping can be very beneficial because, you know, you are the experts on the environment you live in, and you're able to provide us insight into some of those details that we may not have. So that can be very valuable on how we look at our analysis. Resources that may be cumulatively affected. That may affect the same resource. Our schedule, we're doing our scoping now. Comments on the scoping period are due August 18th, next Friday, by close of business. You can, we have information in the back, and if you've got one of the sheets on scoping meetings that tells you how you can comment, you can provide that comment verbally today and it'll be recorded. You're welcome to fill out and leave a written comment today. You can also email comments and mail comments after this meeting, but just by the end of next week. The draft EIR, we've initiated the process of putting that together, pulling together all the existing information. The draft EIR we're anticipating is going to be circulated. It says November to December. The goal is actually early October, if all goes well. But in essence, it'll be available for about a 45-day period, starting in late October and going into early December. And so you'll have an opportunity to comment on that, kind of like the scoping process, where within that time period you can either email or send written comments. And we'll be making that available, I believe, online as well, so you'll have access to it. After the EIR is circulated, we'll take all your comments, prepare what we can call a final EIR. It'll be a supplemental document that will have copies of all the comments. And then we'll finalize that and prepare that and package that late January or mid-January, and have it available for the Commission in early February for consideration. And they will make their decisions at that time. So our goal today is we really want to hear from you. and we really value your input, and we want to know, based on the things we presented, what comments you have. So with that, I think we'll get started. Go ahead, Paul.
I'd like to ask Jeff a question. This is not rehearsed, by the way, but I know many people in the audience and others.
CEQA focuses on physical effects on the environment. So in the slide that I showed you with those different subject headings, it would address, are there air quality impacts, for instance, or are there noise impacts? And so it doesn't look at socioeconomic impact directly. The CEQA analysis wouldn't address, is there an economic effect? But what it would address is, are there other physical environmental effects that result example relevant to this project, if an MPA design forces greater fishing pressure in another area, so now you have a higher concentration of fishermen in another zone, is there a potential physical environmental effect that results from that? For instance, a biological effect. Is there going to be an effect on the actual resource that we're going after in that location for fish species? But it is a good point to raise that if you're looking at the CEQA analysis to be a way to address the economic impact to an industry, it really doesn't cover that. We will actually address that in the document in terms of what is the available information that we know. And we have to look at it in terms of what are the potential outcomes relative to the physical environment. So we will address that. Things like shift in vessel traffic is another one that I can think of. That said, my understanding and what I've seen is that Fish and Game is separately from this process looking at the economics of the decision that's being made. And there's other studies, and you guys are probably well aware of, like, even the EcoTrust data, that's even useful to us in terms of preference for areas and what the impact might be by closing off one area and forcing people to go to a different area. But that is a good thing, I think, to clarify.
Thank you.
So we're going to looks like we have 14 commenters, so I think what we'll go ahead and do is start off giving everybody 5 minutes, and if we have time afterwards, if we have either any follow-up, we have more cards too, we can have people come back up.
Great.
Okay. I'll identify people in groups of threes, just so you're aware of who's coming up. But if you could just come up to the microphone, just introduce yourself and tell us what you have to say. And Marisa will be keeping track of time, so we'll let you guys know when you're 5 minutes up. Sorry we don't have the fancy lights and bells and whistles, but it might be better if we're not shining bright yellow, red, and green lights in your face. So. Whiskey, and then Joey Recano.
Hello, I'm Amber Davis. I wish I had a PowerPoint in front of me so I could address each one of those issues. But I'm going to speak to you about a very specific area within this subsection here, I guess, which is subsection 6, and that is the Morro-Bay National at least that felt like all last week was only one day. And what was a disturbing fact, and it's actually quite disturbing to a lot of folks that really weren't aware of this, is that the two estuaries that are within the confines of Central Coast, Elkhorn Slough and Morro Bay National Estuary, are being treated in very different manners. Within the confines of these marine protected areas are, which would be primarily number one, which addresses diversity, and number four, which addresses unique habitats for the intrinsic value. Morro Bay National Estuary has not been dealt with in a fair manner. It is not entirely clear to me, although there were comments made by staff that the only reason why Morro Bay National Estuary was not being was because of the hunting issues. Unfortunately, and I understand why they have done this, unfortunately that does not meet the current mandates, nor does it really adequately address the fact that Morro Bay National Estuary is a one-of-a-kind habitat, or actually ecosystem within the Central Coast. It is crucial to the fisheries in the near, and actually, obviously, the fishermen have addressed was put forward by staff. There are significant protections for Morro Bay National Estuary. Within the staff's own report and their recommendations, there are literally no protections, or very little, other than for the salt marsh, which is already protected right now. So I do not believe that they have met their mandates when it comes to diversity and really how important this particular that are not even evident in Elkhorn Slough. I believe if you were to make a comparison, I mean, I don't want to because Elkhorn Slough is an incredible place. It needs those protections. But Morro Bay needs those, if not even more. Number one, it's a national estuary. They are currently doing, and this is information you might want to refer to, SLOSEA, which is a group that has put together, they are doing an ecosystem and considers this to be important enough and this habitat to be important enough to look into these kinds of protections. Yet, Fish and Game staff considers this place to be not even worthy of protection in deference to a handful of hunters. At least that's the only thing that they've said so far. I understand that the hunters want to continue to hunt here, but we are addressing marine protected areas and to not meet the mandates that is very important. It's not only important as a marine habitat, it's also important to migrating birds that are coming here. And the mudflats, the acres of mudflats that are here. If you talk to some of the old timers and you talk to them about the biodiversity and just the amount of wildlife, bivalves, just straight I mean, it's just incredible. You can barely even find a goody duck out there. It is, what I'm telling you is this, and I could ramble on and on because I spend a tremendous amount of time out on the estuary. I'm a naturalist out here. Is that this estuary has not been dealt with in an appropriate manner when it comes to protections. It deserves at least the protection of a state marine conservation area, if not an SMR, complete protections. Foundation, what they're doing with that, and to also speak to Dan Berman from the National Estuary Program. So yeah, if you could check those things out, because I was incredibly distressed when I saw the lack of protections. Okay, is there anything else that I need to be addressing? Because I am addressing a very small area. I mean.
Well, you've covered quite a bit, but I think if there's any details that we might be missing in terms of other projects, other things going on that we might want to be aware of, that would be very helpful. if you have knowledge of certain types of environmental effects that you foresee as a result of the project, I would identify those. That would be...
Well, yeah, there's some huge effects. I mean, number one, even the commercial fishermen will tell you that there's very little fishing, at least almost nil from a commercial standpoint. There's very little recreational fishing that goes. You would not be affecting a very large group of recreational individuals. And there are some species, absolutely, that deserve the protection that aren't getting it. The bat rays are constantly being yanked out. So are the sharks. I mean, I have evidence of this, and, you know, people tell you this constantly. So you need to look into that. Thanks a lot.
Sure. Friends, we stand at a crossroads here at the central coast of California. The obvious choice for this area is the most protective, which is 2R. Let me talk about the biological reasons for this. I know that's the amazing discovery of a certain species of elasmobranch here. And elasmobranch, for those at home, are the very primitive creatures that include sharks, rays. And there's a special elasmobranch that lives only in murky water and has a unique physiology. And this water to salt water at will, back and forth. Not like anadromous trout or salmon or steelhead. This is not a once-in-a-lifetime thing. This is something that they do as a matter of their daily routine. No less than 3 of these elasmobranchs have been found here. I've personally held their rostrums in my hand. A rostrum is a nose to the Moat Marine Laboratories in Sarasota, Florida, and the Ocean Conservancy aren't even known to occur on the western seaboard. Now, there are 2 types of sawfish. One of them is the little-toothed sawfish, who is listed under the Endangered Species Act as critically endangered. Then you have the large-toothed sawfish, and the reason they are not listed is because they are not known to occur the local fishermen had cut off their noses and given them to the children who were running around on Morro Bay Boulevard with them. And I held them in my hand. And I took it and smelled it to make sure it was fresh and not some relic brought in from elsewhere. And it was fresh indeed. So we have a lot of attention on that. Further, the Morro Bay estuary watershed is probably the most imperiled The first thing we did was come here and stop Morro Bay in their sewage dumping with the 301H sewage waiver that allows Morro Bay to dump some of the dirtiest sewage in the nation. One of only 2 waivers left in California. The other is San Diego at Point Loma that has international complications. Also, you have the single pass cooling intake of the former Duke power plant here. That power plant is on the verge of area between E. coli being delivered from creeks, southern sea otters being impacted, 9 times greater incidence of toxoplasmosis within 75 kilometers of the area. I mean, you just have a tremendous amount of impact here. Nothing could be better than to give this area the protection it deserves, the Morro Bay National Estuary. All kinds of signs of life here now among the people. And on September 2nd in this very room, you're going to have one of the biggest environmental meetings in the history of California called the TAB meeting, the Talk About the Bay meeting. The keynote speaker will be Pedro Nava from the Ocean Protections Council. You'll have Haiti DeBritz from UC Davis giving the toxoplasmosis findings. You're going to have Dan Berman, the National Estuary Program. Land use issues, and there'll be more. And it's a very exciting time, but
mostly what we're looking at here are new species. There are a lot of work to do. And it's important that we start to pay special attention to the Morro Bay National Estuary and the watershed as a whole. And I think that with the Talk About the Bay meeting coming up, and then another meeting coming right up after that with the National tremendous attention on this area. And so I urge you to go back and tell your superiors that we want the top protection that this place has always deserved, as one of the former speakers had said. I thank you for this opportunity to address you today.
Thank you. So Richard Sadowski? Sadowski. And then after Richard, we have...
Richard Sadowski. I'm a mechanical engineer and represent the Ocean Outfall Group. I had the good fortune of being able to scuba dive all along this coast here. We used to work at Vandenberg and off Point Agüello, and we used to dive the wrecks over there. Fish and also worked for one of the people that is engraved. His H.W. Anderson, his name is engraved on the Morro Bay Memorial, the Anchor Memorial on the Embarcadero. One of the major things that this attracted this I strongly urge all these organizing agencies to go for the most protected area, and that's 2R, and it's worth protecting. The amount of change just in the last 10 years, if you scuba dive and look at the area, is phenomenal. And I think that there's a lot of fishermen. The Ocean Outfall Group was represented in at a meeting in Monterey with the Ocean Protection Council, and a lot of fishermen are receptive. Shorebanks Industries were receptive to the fact that the environmental agencies are not fishermen. We want responsibility taken, and there's a way to do that, and that's through education, and it's through caring for your environment that you live in. So I would strongly urge this council to take the most protected area, please. Thank you.
I've been a resident here for 38 years. I've been a commercial fisherman here for most of those years. I used to run charter boats, so I'm one of those old-timers some of these people were talking about. And I'd like to address the problem that a no-fishing zone, a no-take zone, does not cure pollution. It does not cure a power plant. It does not cure the stuff. It has absolutely nothing to do with the protections that the last speakers were talking about. Absolutely nothing. What it has is this environmental process. Will CEQA take into account the peer review that was done on the original theories of these environmental problems here that they have? You know, with MPPAs, they have their theories and we had ours, and we asked a scientist to have a peer review, an independent peer review, and it was done. Will the CEQA process organizations that got to choose the scientist? They chose the scientist that brought this process into being now with their theories. And I know that they were biased. I know that. And so does most of the other people here that, you know, that's just the way it is. Another concern is that when you do put these MPAs in, the shift in effort, what will do the other areas, you mentioned that, but also also know this isn't written in stone, that you can add or subtract from these things. There are no reason to go over restrictive. One of the things that you should take into account is a precautionary principle. They use that for the environment, and you have unintended consequences that can happen. If you implement these MPAs in Central Coast first before you do the rest of the state, those fishermen will go up and impact other areas. And then what kind of a fish before the other one, you want to do these comparisons between areas, you see. That makes a difference also for the data that comes out of this. And I don't know, on that precautionary principle, there are unintended consequences of environmental laws. They talk about this bay being devastated. Oh, it was devastated, all right. You go down to the pilings, you will not find a grown mussel on those pilings. You won't find a clam in the bay. You'll find very small . We used to have a lot of fisheries here for clams, both sport, all up and down. And they had a lot of life in this bay. We had jack snout and perch eating the mussels that were crushed by the boats when they come in at low tide against the pilings. We had rock crabs all over the bay because the sport fishermen used to dump the carcasses in the bay, and the city in their fine attitude stopped that. That used to feed the crabs and also used to feed the other fish. It was a whole variety of stuff that was stopped. When the otters came now, you won't find thousands of them. And they talk about ecosystem-based management. They refuse to look at the sea lion population, the otters. You say that's the federal problem. It is a California problem. Most of those sea lions live in 3 miles from the beach. And you want to address that? They have to address that. Otherwise, we're not sure what the consequence is going to be of these protected areas in the first place. Sea lion eats 20 pounds of fish a day. There's about approximately 250,000, last count I heard, maybe. Million pounds of fish they eat each year. So what are these no fishing zones going to do? Are they going to help? Maybe in some areas, but I would suggest that you go with a precautionary principle and you use the least amount of restriction first, see how those go. Don't implement those until the whole state is done. And if that's not in the secret process, I believe that you would be mistaken. Thank you.
John Stilton, then Janice Peters, and then, I don't know if I'm reading this right, Jean Johi?
Hello, I'm John Usselton, and I'm a local resident of Moorabbin. I've lived in this community since 1970. To be a commercial fisherman, which was my dream, but I have a concern about the MLP process because it does have its own direction, but it seems to me that it still needs to be umbrellaed by the mission statement of the Department of Fish and Game. I understand it has its own directive, Department of Fish and Game. The mission of the Department of Fish and Game is to manage California's diverse fish, wildlife, and plant resources and the habitats upon which they depend for their ecological values and for their use and enjoyment of the public. This includes habitat protection and maintenance in a sufficient amount of and quality to ensure the survival of all. Diversified use of fish and wildlife, including recreational, commercial, scientific, and educational uses. The reason I read this mission statement, because I was taught in education that you do the least restrictive first before you do the most restrictive. You want to be sure that you're not going too far one way in terms of your restrictions. Package P. Now, as a commercial fisherman, I've been involved in helping develop all of the fishery areas for several years. I've been interviewed. I've been taken out to dinner. I have been gone through all the different areas where we would like not to have the fishing, where all the fishing is. And I thought we had a verbal agreement on package one. Somebody's come up with package P. I have no idea. We were in Morro Bay, they were going to have a statement of the city council to support package one, and they had just gotten package P, and they couldn't even make a statement on it because it was so new, and we didn't even have a chance to look at it or discuss it or anything. It seems to me that, and that's why I am concerned, that it's not under the umbrella of the mission statement. Therefore, I feel it's wrong, inherently wrong, to come up with package P without enough talk. I may be wrong, but it seems to me the commission voted to not even have the public hearing, except for Michael Flores vetoed that. So my feeling is that they don't even want to hear this in the first place. I wouldn't be standing here. So that is one of the things I want to bring up in terms of the mission statement. I think package P is detrimental. I think if the Department of Fish and Game passes package P, it will be the end of Virgin Sport Fishing. You want to walk down and see the beautiful boats and all the things. I just don't see how anybody could survive with this package. And in fact, anywhere some of the commissioners were squawking about even moving it 2 miles. People, there isn't going to be anybody here to sport fish. If package P is taken in, there's not going to be any sport fishing anywhere. There won't be any boat ramp. What are people going to do? You can't fish. I have my nephews and I have grandchildren that come. If the commissioners select package P, there is nowhere to fish. Sorry, that's just the way it is. It is too restrictive. According to the umbrella of the mission statement, is for the enjoyment by the public. If you put in package P, where am I? Consider these factors. I will talk again about this. My 5 minutes is up. I will see you in Monterey. Please, package P is too restrictive. Thank you.
Thank you.
Before you get started, a couple thoughts. One, there may be a little clarification. The speaker, the comment slips may have the old date. The original official date for the scoping period was to end on August 15th, but some of our noticing materials are the 18th, so we extend it to the 18th. So if you see the 15th, ignore it. And and then just a friendly reminder that, in terms of your comments, try to focus on what's most beneficial to us, I think, is focusing on some of these types of issues relative to these packages and making that link, because we don't influence the decision in terms of the selection of a package or what your preference would be. But if you think that there's an environmental issue that needs to be addressed in that, please speak up about that. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Janice Peters. I'm the mayor of Morro Bay. Thank you for coming here. It's very nice to be able to speak in our own town about the concerns. I appreciate that. And I'm glad that you said that the socioeconomic issues are going to be looked at. That's really important to our city. But going from the CEQA list, recreation is affected. Fuel use, distance that we have to travel to fish, the pollution due to that further distance and the fuel used, and greater costs involved, that does affect recreation and the costs of providing recreational fishing. Biological resources and cumulative effects. The proposed closures on top of existing ones will result in a tremendous amount of overfishing in the areas that are still open by all of the fishermen trying to sustain a living in those small areas. Public services, the fuel dock, ice machines, supporting infrastructure, those will all be threatened if there is no fishing industry to support them and need them any longer. Environmental concerns, I guess, I wonder about where our environmental concerns start and stop. Yes, we can control environmental concerns right here and protect these fish that are along our borders, and then the world is going to keep buying fish from other countries where they don't protect the fish along their borders, And so where does our environmental responsibility start and stop? Is it only in California? Or should we be concerned about balancing fishing throughout the world so that we don't disturb it or destroy it anywhere? Fishing is the oldest profession in the world. It's the oldest food source that we have harvested for centuries. It's not a bad thing. And I think that the important thing we have to look for always is balance. Balance of our environment, balance of our human species as well. And I would hope that we do consider the human species as something that we want to protect. Public access, infrastructure, maintaining those for economic and recreational uses should also be part of the process. I hope you'll consider those. Thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
Hello, gentlemen. My name is Gene Joy, and I'm not part of the process. It's the first time that I really wanted to speak about something, and being born and raised around here, I've fished the ocean quite a bit as a recreational fisherman, but I do have friends that are commercial fishermen. And what I'm here today to, really is to ask, what impact have the past commercial restrictions or regulations had an effect on our current fish population? And what I'm referring to, I may be off a few deals here and there, but I'm pretty close. I like to refer to gillnet fishing, which has been reduced dramatically. From what I understand, there used to be 50-plus boats, and now that's been reduced to a half a dozen due to the new regulations. From fishing with no depth limit to restricted minimum depth of 150 feet or more, these restrictions must have had some effect on the fish population. I'm asking what the impact is there. Long line fishing. Before, you could fish with 7 lines a quarter mile long with 1,000 hooks per line. Now you're allowed 150 hooks total. These regulations have reduced the fleet to 1/10 of what it used to be because they can't make a living. These restrictions surely must have increased the fish population. Otherwise, they wouldn't be implemented. Also, this last year, I've heard this or read it, that 400 square miles off the California coast has been closed to commercial fishing this past year. This surely has to add to the improvement of the fish population by itself. Before there were 10 to 15, I'm talking locally, before there were 10 to 15 drag boats between Avalon and Morro Bay, you could drag up to, a lot of times they brought in 40, 45,000 pounds of fish, and you were able to go back out in the ocean as soon as you were able to. There was no restrictions. Now there's a 20-ton limit for every 3 months of fishing. So the fleet is down to 1 or 2 boats now instead of what it was before. This must have some effect on the fish population. Nearshore and deep water fishing has changed from an unlimited pounds of fish to 500 pounds per month. It wasn't too long ago that you could go out there and get an unlimited amount of fish by nearshore fishing. There was no limit. Now it's 500 pounds a month. Therefore, another regulation came into effect, which I understand, 8 out of 10 licenses for this type of fishing were taken away because somewhere in 2000, 2001, whatever, in order to keep your license, you had to show landings per receipt from 1989 to 1999. If you didn't have receipts for the landing of these fish, then the department did not renew your license or basically took them away. Not all licensed fishermen had those receipts, and so a lot of them were not renewed. This must have had some reflect on nearshore fishing. Then they created a new regulation that if you wanted to go and nearshore fish or offshore fish, you had to purchase 2 old licenses in order to fish. And the idea is to eventually phase out that totally at the end. So this will have a dramatic effect on nearshore fishing or offshore fishing. What I understand from several dozen nearshore fishermen in our area, there's about a half a dozen left because this is action in the new regulations. So that has dramatically reduced the nearshore fishermen. Sport fishing, the commercial fishing season, has been reduced from 12 months to 5. Surely this must have some effect on the fish population. So what I'm saying, with all this being done already, why do we need to restrict fishing further in and around Morro Bay for recreational fishermen like myself? We haven't given the prior restrictions enough time to work out. Now you're asking us to close off the most important areas of our coast to all fishing. The impact on me is I'll probably end up selling my fishing boats, which I have too. I don't expect to get a fishing license because there probably won't be that, a good area to fish, or the fishing won't be worth it. So to me personally, it will probably end my fishing in and around Morro Bay and Avila. And my son, which is right there, he probably will never see fishing again. I used to take him with me. So you have a young man there that will never be able to do what I did. Thank you very much.
And then Alan Allward and Tom Haffer.
I'm Mike McCorkle, and I wasn't quite sure what the CEQA process included, and now I understand. So what I wanted to talk about today isn't included in the CEQA process. And what I wanted to talk about today was the movement of California halibut and the category it's in the listing of fish movement. And as a category 2, it should be in category 4 along with Pacific halibut. I won't get into why. We can prove why, but that's what I wanted to talk about. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Alan Allward, and I'm a commercial fisherman. I can see two topics up here that I'd like to talk about. I feel that fishermen in general in this state are endangered, as one of the previous speakers was talking about. We've had a lot of laws. They're multiplying like rabbits, and more restrictions all the time. And with something like this, the beginning of parkification of the ocean, where you actually take big areas and you close them off, is going to kill . You see, all the boats are derelict. Nobody can afford to fix them. They're sinking at the dock because nobody can make any money, because we just have this continuing increase of regulations and layer upon layer. Not only Fish and Game has complete control. They can tell us exactly how many fish to take, what days we can fish, everything. That's fine. We love that. That's management. That's taken from the ocean without killing off the stock. But when you start parkifying and closing areas entirely, how far do you have to go when you go outside the harbor? How far do you have to go before you come to a point where you can fish, a rocky point that's productive of fish? Now, when this law was passed, the idea was that we're going to have diverse areas. We're going to have everybody said, well, wait a minute, what are the most productive areas? Well, from the people that want to stop all fishing say the most productive areas are the areas we have to conserve. The fisherman says the most productive areas are the places I want to go to fish. So you got to look at what's being taken away. All the rocky points, how far do you have to go to come to a rocky point that's productive for fish? Down there, well, if you go down Point Bouchon, you motor 20 miles south, it's ludicrous. There should be points where a person can go and fish that are productive, good fishing areas, that are open to fishermen, that should be left open to fishermen. Why close everything? It's preposterous. That's it for me.
Tom Haper, commercial fisherman near Shore and Spot Prawn. What I'm most worried about is a couple things. Like this last speaker said, they've taken all of our best fishing grounds away. Point Sur, Big Creek, Piedras Blancas, Bouchon, Parisma. Now, one of the things to small little areas and small reefs where we're used to going to big reefs that will stand in nearshore fishery, and they're closing us down to these little small reefs and small little areas. We're going to have a lot of problems with the nearshore fishing, because right now we're all spread out. We all go to our own areas, and you cram us. Of rock, there's going to be problems. And then another problem is running. I can run to Point Sur, stay there for 3 days knowing I'm going to get my quota, come home, and then I'm done for the 2 month wave. Now I'm going to have to burn hundreds of gallons of fuel to fill my quota at these small little areas you're leaving. That's a big problem. And the reefs are going to get a lot more people fishing on them, these small little areas. I don't understand why they had to take all our best fishing grounds either. EcoTrust, like you mentioned, EcoTrust, they came into town, they had the commercial fishermen say, okay, we're going to ask you guys where you're going to fish at. Where do you fish at? Because we want to know, because we don't want to take them from you. We want to make the impact as light as our best fishing grounds are. You know, they literally lied to us. So we're pretty upset about that. So there's a lot of other environmental impacts that are going to occur on this too, like air quality, populations of fish. I'm going to need to get that. Thanks anyway.
Thank you. I apologize. I'm going to continue to put your names, but is it Shay Hafer?
Yeah. Sherry.
Sherry, okay. That was my second guess. Sorry. And then Eric? Mendersty?
Mendersty, possibly. D with an E.
Okay. SEEK was about, so we went on Google, and we looked up some different case studies done mostly with terrestrial projects, not with marine projects, so we're not sure how they apply. But I picked out a few. One was Antioch versus Pittsburgh in 1986. And with that project, they comprehensively described. And we really feel that they haven't done their homework in getting the baseline data that they really need to get. I have in my little book here a thing on what the STAR panel requested as research recommendations to get. We only have 4 stock assessments for the 19 near shore species. And they need better accurate accounting of removals. They need better fishery independent surveys. We really feel like there should be CPU studies all along the coast before these reserves go in so they know where they're starting at. Otherwise, they're going to say that the improvements on they need to study the stock structure better. They need better age determination on when they spawn. They need to study the climate and how it affects the fish. They need sex-specific data, all this stuff. They're very specific. But the only thing that they're using on the nearshore fishery is crane right now. The last report, in May 2006, under fishery control rule, under conductive research, they write crane. In crane, the only way they study things is through diver visual surveys and these benthic swath transects, which is like sponges that collect baby fish. But they're really not getting the data that they really need to is that they're data poor, and they really can't change our total allowable catch because they don't have enough data to really allow us to catch more. But it's kind of a catch-22 because then they say, oh, but there's enough data to put in reserves. You know, so to us, there's still data poor. They really don't know where they're at with things, and it's really too early to start putting in reserves. It needs to be done there first before jumping in and doing all of California. We really want to know what they've learned from the Channel Islands. So that was one thing. And then the next one, they in Citizens of Goleta versus Board of Supervisors, in that project, they demanded that they project. It had to be feasible, there had to be economic viability and available infrastructure to do the project. Okay, well, the governor, because he's being swindled into it, has said that he'll give, I think it's $7 million up front for implementing the MPAs. Okay, well, that's for implementation. That's no promise that they're going to monitor it and continue doing it. So the state is nowhere near to promising enough money to really take care of these reserves and be able to monitor them, especially for what they want. Just the Central Coast alone, they want 200 miles of reserves. I mean, before, I don't know what Big Creek was before, they couldn't even monitor Big Creek, which is only 2 miles long. So it's just kind of crazy that they think they're going to pay for this now. And we want to see where the promise. Do it, or they should start with something much smaller. Okay, then that's number two. Number three, there's a study, Laurel Heights Improvement Association versus Regents of University of California, 1988, and what it said was you have to study the potential negative impacts to neighboring areas. Okay, so there. And the scientists that they hired really didn't want to talk about neighboring effects or displaced fishing. They wanted to act like commercial fishing and recreational fishing didn't exist, or I don't know. They didn't really take it into account what would happen when they did all this. They didn't care. They just wanted to take a certain amount of habitat. And so we had this peer review, and they had some good at the commission meeting, we thought. The first thing is they said there's no evidence that the current fishing practices upset natural biological diversity. There's no evidence. The second is there's no empirical evidence that marine reserves work in the northern hemisphere. They've only proven that they've worked in tropical areas that are totally different than here. Okay, and they said that that entrain nearshore larvae and transport it offshore. If larval retention is a critical factor in recruitment, packages 2, 3, and P have a majority of their MPAs located at henland locations. This could result in a net loss of biomass in comparison to the status quo. So what they're saying is where they're putting all these reserves are at points. You've heard all the guys say they're all at the headlands, they're all at the points. All the larvae is going to be and so they're saying, I mean, the Fish and Game says that's what we want it to do. We want it to send the larva out. But there's other scientists that don't agree with that. So there's some argument there, and there's a potential net negative impact. So that should be studied. The other thing is They said that it would be better if there's equal percentage of habitats. The way P is set up, it's taken 57% of the hard bottom from 30 to 100 fathom feet. 57%. So that's totally unnecessary. They only needed to take 10% in the nearshore fishery management plan. So I think they've really gone overboard, and there's going to be impact. When it says here, alternations of this magnitude will cause severe changes in distribution of fishing effort. So.
Eric? You're close. It's Eric Endersby. I'm here representing the Recreational Fishing Alliance, California Fisheries Coalition, and the City of Morro Bay Harbor Department. I'll try and make some pretty specific comments here. Number one, please include Package 1 in the CEQA analysis. CEQA should also address the impacts and ramifications of displaced fishing effort. The other folks have already mentioned that. By having to travel further and farther to fish longer for a reasonable, satisfying recreational fishing experience, fishermen will burn more fuel, which equates to pollution, to do so. And the same applies to commercial fishermen. In order to make a living, fishermen are going to have to travel further and fish longer in order to make a living. That equates to more pollution. I think Tom Hafer brought that up. For both recreational and commercial fishermen, often traveling extra time and extra distance equates to a safety factor. If you're having to go around and dodge MPAs to get to fishing grounds that are productive, urban encroachment, ag and cattle runoff. If you talk about Monterey Bay, the whole Salinas Valley drains into Monterey Bay. That needs to be factored in. Effects of historically overpopulated marine mammals on fished and non-fished species. I think Tom Hafer did some fish trap studies up at Big Creek here in the last month or so. And the whole story's not in yet, but he pretty much saw nothing but lingcod and doing in his traps and saw nothing on the beach but harbor seals, and they caught very somebody mentioned it keeps getting brought up. That's a federally managed species. Well, it's having an effect, and we need to know what the effect is. Description of the existing environment, including baseline data of fish stocks and current levels of fishing and their sustainability. Tom and Sherry just brought up, and a couple other folks brought up, the layers upon layers upon layers of fishery management over the last 10 years. They're obviously having effect. Things are robust, and there's a lot of fish out there. A couple other notes I made from some of the other talkers brought some jogged some memory cells that I've got here. That may not affect our immediate environment, but it sure affects the rest of the world. This country's appetite for seafood is not getting any less. It's getting greater, if anything. And that fish has got to come from somewhere, and the people are going to buy it. If it's not coming from here where things are fished very sustainably, it's going to come from somewhere where it's not fished sustainably. And finally, another comment that was brought up about as far as sinking boats and mothballed fleet. This one's pretty near and dear to my heart recently. We had a environmental impact. I mean, I don't know how many tens, if not hundreds of gallons of fuel spilled. Took probably $250,000 worth of effort to raise that boat, and untold amounts of pollution in this bay. That's getting repeated up and down the coast as guys get regulated out of business. You can't, bring your boat to the junkyard and just sign your pink slip over. Something has to happen to it. So please consider these things. Thank you.
Daniel Berman.
He's not here. Daniel Berman's not here.
Who's that?
Daniel Berman is not here.
Okay. Judah Sanders?
Hi. Thanks for hearing my commentary today. My name is Judah Sanders. I've been a resident here for the last 11 years. Relatively short compared to some of the guys. dove extensively along the coast in many of the regions that are in discussion here. One of the things that I look at here is that we have a large section of coastline, and most of it is, or a lot of it is sand, and then there's these prime habitat rocky reef areas. Some of the people have talked about that already. The graphs that you show in your chart, coastline being protected, but what that doesn't show, because none of us fishermen or divers want to go jump over a sandy bottom. That's pretty much clear. And so if you were to overlay the best habitats over that map, the areas that are being protected, it doesn't represent what the coastline is really has to offer for us recreationally. The prime habitat is put onto the reserve if package P is put into effect. It's not 9 to 13% as the graphs are showing, because the sandy bottoms do nothing. I mean, they're great habitat, but they really aren't very diverse. And it's pretty obvious by looking at the plan that wasn't what they were for. Now, I may be at odds with some of the commercial guys here. Have no motor areas been considered along the coastline at all? I mean, for kayakers, for paddleboarders, so that they can go out for shore fishermen. This would reduce pollution, and it would also reduce noise in those areas. So that's just one other thing to put on the table. I know it probably won't be considered at this point in time. We have a big area of Vandenberg that's 35 miles of coastline where we don't have any access to. We have 8 miles of coastline off Diablo Canyon. We have no access there. As you head north from Cayucas, you hit an area of private land, which is pretty significant. And from there all the way through Big Sur, we have very few access points. Cambria is one of the few access points that we do have. Entire area off Cambria would be completely off limits to any fishing. That means that the kayak fisherman that wants to go out with his kids can't go out there to Cambria Reef anymore. I know Cambria Reef is very diverse. I believe in protection, and I think that there's a plan where part of that reef can be protected and part of it can be open for the public still. That's all we're really asking for, is some type of just for some recreational fishing opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you. Rick Albert. And then Henriette Groot. And Steve Rebuck.
Thank you for coming. My name is Rick Albert. I'm City of Morro Bay Harbor Director. I hope you do consider public access. Package one is a couple of quick examples. Package one. Site for improving public access rather than restricting public access. I hope you do consider socioeconomic impacts. Socioeconomics may be outside the scope in state, and federal it probably would not be. You would have to be included in state. I think you need to look at the socioeconomics so you can understand some of the environmental impacts and the public access impacts too. For example, if Verge's fishing costs go up, public access impacts do those have? I think quite substantial, since Burgess Fishing provides the low-cost fishing opportunity for those folks who can't afford their own boats. That's the only opportunity in this area besides, of course, Port St. Louis. Another example, you have to understand the socioeconomics, I think, to understand the environmental impacts might be that if our continuing drop in volume of fuel sales here makes it unfeasible for the last remaining fuel dock to remain in operation. Pollution to get fuel from Morro Bay. So please look at those things. Finally, I also want to say something about the abandoned vessel issue. It We did recently have a major incident here. A lot of people became aware of it and were very frustrated with the pollution caused by it. We've been dealing with these things for a long, long time, not quite that large, because unfortunately that was caused by the in 2001, but Paul, you might remember it better than I. That individual had no other legal fisheries with that vessel once that fishing that permit was taken away. The vessel became neglected. We became aware of its poor condition about 60 days ago. It sank about 20 days ago, probably now, with a large pollution incident associated with it. Now, I want to have taken care of it. He should have looked for solutions. There's no question about that. So there's a difference between cause and responsibility. In my mind, it was directly caused by the closing of that fishery and an easy to predict event. And I can predict a number of other events that will come out of other fisheries closures and will come if these, if the most restrictive closures are put in the proposed MPA packages. There will be additional boats that will be abandoned. Those owners will agencies will get stuck with them, and there will be pollution incidents, so I hope you consider those. The City of Morro Bay will supply you with written comments next week.
Thank you.
My name is Henrietta Groot. I live at Cayucas. I want to tell you that you've got the cart before the horse here. You keep getting comments about people. Told us what the plan is. How can we have a scoping session on a program that we don't know what it is? I contend that this is not an appropriate scoping session under CEQA. And I also feel that you should have your real scoping session after which plan they're going to go with. Then we can make sense in our comments. Then we can really tell you what the issues are, and we won't keep jumping back and forth between package P versus 1 or 2R or what have you. I have comments I would make about those packages, but I will make them next week in Monterey. So I think you should at least extend the deadline for scoping and not close it on the 18th. I also want to tell you that the website, which I checked today, did not mention this meeting, did not mention the Monterey meeting. Maybe I'm inadequate in how I find things on a website, but you might take a look at that and see whether the rest of my comments I'll make in writing. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve Reebok.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Reebok. For over 20 years, I represented commercial fishermen up and down the coast. San Diego to fish abalone. I started diving here in 1956, so I've seen a lot of change. There were legal abalone inside the bay. I got my last one in 1966 before I went in the U.S. Army, and that was at Target Rock. I kind of feel like these fishermen here today are like the Israelis. The more land they give up, the more they get blamed and the more they get bombed. And I'm not in favor of any of these impacts. Years, I've seen a lot of change. The biggest change, the biggest cause of change in this area is not fishing pressure, it's marine mammals. It's seals and sea lions, and it's the range expansion and population increase of the sea otter. And scoping, as I understand it, is identifying new information, and my information is in regards to ecological issues. But based on this document, the California Marine Protected Areas by Deborah McArdle, there's 103 marine protected areas listed in here. And in this assessment, what I'd like to see is how have they worked? Have they accomplished the objectives when they were established? And if not, explain why. Now, a couple of months ago, I gave a talk on abalone up at Monterey. There were two armadillos. These were ladies that were 68 and 72 years old with over 50 years of diving experience. They dove Point Lobos. In the question and answer session, they identified one living organism that they saw, sea cucumber. Saw no abalone, no fish. I've been up there. I've been in the water because you got to get on a list, but you can't see starfish on the beach. Or it looks pretty much like the coast. Reserve now since 1960, and yet it's a desert. The second assessment I'd like to see is in regards to marine mammals, their impact on fish and shellfish. We have robust populations now increasing up and down the coast. At San Miguel Island, for example, there are, as far as I know, 100,000 California sea lions now at 20 pounds of fish per day, which comes there's no fisheries in the region that even come close to those kinds of numbers. And how do you do an assessment on fish mortality and not address marine mammals, to me is folly. Now down here we have some pismo clam reserves and invertebrate reserves. A couple of years ago there was an effort to maybe remove those from this 103. When you have these robust populations of marine mammals, it doesn't matter if you have a reserve, you're not going to have more fish. And then the third assessment that I'd like to encourage would be the justification for MPAs themselves. I've been following this for more than 10 years. In my opinion, this was a political debate, not based in science, but politicians giving themselves a pat on the back for doing something. Well, I don't think they've done anything. Marine environment. Thanks for coming to town. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next we have Gene Newselton, Roger Anderson, and then Bob Koch.
Hello, I'm Gene Newselton, and I had no intention. I guess I'm here to address recreation and economic impacts. First of all, I think we're all environmentalists. None of us wants all the fish to go away. None of us wants the ocean to be depleted. And I really appreciated what the lady said before about how fishing is not a bad thing. Okay, it's a good thing, and it's healthy. Trust us. We want to know. We don't want to close all your places. You know, please help us so that this doesn't happen. My husband was quite impressed that they would actually ask him for his opinion. Turns out that was one of the reasons people say don't trust people. You know, they took all the information that all the fishermen said and they said, oh, well, that sounds good. We'll close all of those. It doesn't make sense to me. When I teach my kindergartners, and they give me an answer, I say to them, does that make sense? None of it makes sense to me. My husband and I've lived here all my life. I'm 56 years old. I like living by the ocean. I like to be able to take my children and hopefully someday my grandchildren fishing. But they're not going to be able to do that because there isn't going to be any reason to go fishing. My husband and I have both been gainfully employed, responsible citizens for all of our lives. Becoming a commercial salmon fisherman full-time instead of part-time, and now he's not even going to be able to do that. And I guess my final comment is that even the Fish and Games, Department of Fish and Game scientists don't agree with the data. They know it's flawed. We all know it's flawed. Somebody needs to study it better. I think Package P is for of course, I know what you don't want to hear today, and I'm sorry, but it doesn't make sense to me.
Thank you.
I'm Roger Anderson. I've lived here my whole life in the Central Coast. Actually, we moved from San Luis Obispo to Morro Bay and the Lake as mayor of Morro Bay, been involved in a family business on the waterfront for 40 years. We had a wholesale fish license for a number of years. I've worked with and around commercial fishermen for most of my life. If you give the fishermen good science, they'll endorse you 100%. Salmon, for example, after lengthy drought period, you show it to them, it makes sense, and they will buy in a big way. There's a lot of doubt about the science that's gone into this. Several people testified early on. Take the most restrictive one. If some people had their way, there would be no fishing out there all at people being able to walk their dogs on the beach. We asked that an area that had no plovers be left open. Nope, it's just easier to close the whole thing. Off the record, in a conversation, my take on it was that some agencies were so anxious to avoid litigation that they would rather just back away from a so they would take the course of just bowing down to their wishes. I don't think that's the way to go. When we found out about that plover issue, it was made very clear to us, not only can we keep your dogs off the beach, but if we see fit, we can keep people off the beach altogether. I don't think that mankind is an invasive species here. I think the repopulation of marine mammals, in particular sea lions, if you take fish and game numbers for the estimated population of sea lions and the estimated amount of fish they have to eat in a day or a week or a year, compared to the commercial landings in the state of California, it's far and away greater. Commercial fishermen listen to and they don't feel fairly treated. Package one at least hints of the word compromise. There are some who would advocate for even stricter than what's been proposed. They would advocate for no fishing at all, no human interaction with the shoreline, because that does no damage whatsoever. And I really think that it's compromise. If down the road it doesn't prove to be workable, stronger restrictions can be put in place. government agencies, from my many years' experiences as both an elected and an appointed official and as a businessman, government agencies seldom back down on things. Once something's in place, it's usually there to stay. It's easier to take the message back to, this is a step towards more restriction, but not so great that it puts people out of business completely at this time. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Bob Cope. I'm a retired Fish and Game Patrol lieutenant, retired about 3 years ago. I'm now a commercial fisherman as well as a sport fisherman. My concern was, realizing the Department of Fish and Game has a limited budget to run patrol boats, and that if you have an area that's open to fishing, that's in an area that's near Cambria, where you have a lot of people who would like to fish there or do recreational kayaking or boating, it could be a real burden every time somebody's out there doing something to get phone calls complaining about somebody doing something up there that they may not even be doing. Excuse me? Smaller areas would basically be better and easier to enforce, and those areas should be in areas where there's not a lot of easy access from the coastline, simply because if you get a lot of activity in there, it's difficult for patrol boats to or for people to know exactly what's going on those boats. If you get a lot of nuisance calls, it takes a lot of gas, it takes a lot of diesel fuel, it takes a lot of money to respond to those calls. And in the planning process, that should really be considered, because it is an environmental that time shouldn't be impacted by running a bunch of false calls. And if the areas are too large, that simply increases the demand on the patrol effort. The patrol effort is not just to patrol the MPAs, but to patrol the entire ocean. And patrolmen are appreciated when they're seen out there, but if they spend all their time running on wild goose calls, it could be a real burden. So I think that area up around Cambria is the disaster in the making, and I also feel the area up calls, and this would be a lot of wasted time and money. And the other thing is that I hate to see the goose that laid the golden egg get killed, because the commercial fishermen and the sport fishermen provide an extensive amount of resources in the way of money to the Department of Fish and Game to do its operations. If you cut these areas down too much and people stop fishing, then we're going to have less money to do the research that everybody wants to get done. So that's about it in a nutshell.
And I think our last comment card, possibly, Gary Johnson.
Kind of have to bear with me. I got hearing aids in both ears. I'm from Paso Robles, Tom Wells. I've been fishing on our coast for about 30 years, just as a recreational fisherman. And I dove our coast for about 12 years. And I can remember when, like the gentleman said earlier about some of the marine life problems with the otters and stuff, I can remember when they were was a member of a dive club in Pismo Beach, and we fought it tooth and nail back then, getting some of the otters down into the abalone. I used to take a lot of abalone, a lot of clams. I did it legally, and I did it honestly. I did my limits, and I've seen some just fantastic fishing over the years, and I'll admit some of the cutting back has helped our marine boat for 30 years, and I've got probably 70 rods, and there's a lot of fish out there. But I think if you start restricting our areas to where down to where we're into one area, I think we're going to see some real problems. I mean, I think I hope that we take a more relaxed plan. And I am, like I said, a common man, but I've been fishing all my life, ever since I was born, and I come from an old family of fishermen. But when you take my fishing away, I'll probably do things that I probably would have never done in my life, and I'll probably still continue to fish this coast one way or the other. I'll do it legally or illegally. And I guarantee you, like I said, I come from an old fisherman family. I mean, I used everything from dynamite. I was raised in Texas. I used carbide lights. I used gill nets. First time I ever got a citation, and the only citation I got in California, was I was fishing at Lake Nacimento. I had 6 rods and reels on the bank, and I was fishing for catfish. The fish and game officer came down, and he says, "Where's everybody at, son?" And I said, "Well, it's just me. I'm just catfishing." And he says, "Jim, where are you from?" And I says, "Well, I'm originally from Texas." He handed me a fish and game book, and he says, "I suggest you read this." One fishing rod. And I said, "One fishing rod?" I said, "Well, that's crazy." I says, I've always used 6 or 7 rods, you know. But from that day on, I did it legally. And I followed the rules and the regulations. And I got 9 grandkids, and I'm going to teach them from this on up to this. They're just now coming to the age where they're starting to fish. And we're not taking it away from my grandkids. Handcuffs on me and take me to jail, and I'm not a rich man, but you can take every darn thing I've got, and unless you want to buy my boat and buy my fishing rods, and you're going to have a generation of kids that I'm going to teach how to fish illegally, because I know how to do it, and I won't do it, but I will do it if you try to take it away from me. It's my heritage. It's a heritage that has been here for hundreds of years. Game, but just don't restrict me and don't tell me you're going to take it away from me, because you won't take it away from me, and there's a lot of other guys just like me, and we'll organize one way or the other. I just thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, and thank you. Oh, following that confession, I just have to observe that St. Peter was a fisherman.
You state his name for the record.
Yeah. Could you? And I'm Steve Jenkins. I'm from San Luis Obispo. I formerly was a commissioner on the Port San Luis Harbor District Commission, and I have some process comments that I'd like to suggest. You've heard a number of comments here about how the about rebuilding the resource. That's one of the goals. And there's some concerns about weakness in the baseline data for the current proposal, the preferred proposal. But I think that the MMPA needs to look at something else as you're preparing the environmental impact report. It's not enough just to get the baseline. Resources and restore them, there has to be something that gives benchmarks for when the restoration has occurred included in the report. And it's not enough just to say, for this species, X number in a certain area is a restoration. When you're looking at the culture, the report needs to also examine things like the talent base. Right now, the average fisherman in this state is 60 years old because there's no future in fishing. You've seen one individual come and talk about how his son is never going to be able to go fishing again. Well, his son would ordinarily be the natural next generation of fishermen with the talent that they'd been taught by their fathers or their mothers. Has to be some examination of how to preserve the talent and the infrastructure so that the public in California can use and enjoy these resources when they're restored. The final thought I think that you should include in your examination is one of these elements, population and housing. Population. As long as people learn how to live together and use their resources wisely together, there are not impacts. If the fishing industry is so impacted so quickly, the reality is most everybody has a financed house. They're going to lose that house. They're going to have to go to a lower standard of living. They're going to have to move somewhere else. That is an impact on way of earning a living. So thank you for your time. Thank you for coming to San Luis.
Thank you. I've got one last speaker card for Gary Johnson. And then if Daniel Berman has by some chance come back, I've got a card for him as well.
Hi. I'm glad you guys are able to come here and didn't have about social economics, and then I want to talk about the estuary, and then I want to talk about the ocean itself. Social economics. I feel sorry for the fishermen. You know, I belong to Morro Bay Beautiful, and we pick up trash every Monday morning from the visitors, and I'm on the pier the other day talking to this fisherman about this problem. He says, see this guy over here? He's in debt $60,000. This guy's in debt $40,000. This guy's in debt $30,000. We have to go to Oregon in a couple weeks. Fish. I mean, the social economics of what the state is empowering on these people, I really feel sorry for them. Also, the sport fishermen. I have a vacation rental. My vacation rental is down half because the fishing has stopped because people were coming from the valley, coming over here to fish, and so forth. So something has to happen. If you do this, not only when the government runs into trouble, do they lay off people? No, they don't lay off people. They want to increase taxes so they can keep the same amount of people. But fishermen can't do that. They lose everything in the path. Now, let's talk about the estuary. I get sick and tired of these environmentalists saying how bad the estuary is. Okay, I'm an engineer, retired scientist, working on the satellite programs. We had to have good data before we The reason why I say that, because I take water samples on the estuary, and we look at it under the microscope. It is alive with microscopic marine life that the bigger fish eat. Now, since you're here, go out and look and see how many pelicans are out there in the bay. There's thousands of them this year. I have never seen so many pelicans in my life. Now, why are they there? They have to eat. Now, you go out there, I'm in my kayak because I'm a bird photographer. I'm in the midst of these hundreds of pelicans that are just scarfing up the fish. Now, if it's a dead estuary, you wouldn't have this. And I could go on and on with that. But let's take the ocean for an example. That reason why I'm here, because I heard this gentleman talk about Point Lobos. I'm a scuba diver, and I've been diving here for 38 years. Point Lobos is a protected area. Dozens of sea otters. When I dive that area, he's right. There isn't any abalone. There isn't anything but these cucumbers, these beautiful white cucumbers that maybe be a couple feet high and so forth. And it proves that when you restrict an area to the human race, doesn't mean that you're going to have fish and the abalone and all that. And that proves a good point. Now, a friend of mine was diving last weekend in Avila. He said, Gary, you should see the fish out there. My God. He says, I dove that pinnacle. We made two dives, and we chose some of the bigger fish. there were hundreds of fish out there around the pinnacles. I says, no, Sean, the fish and game, the environmentalists say there isn't any fish. And so a couple weeks ago, he was down in the Sterile Bay, down by one of the reefs out there. He was telling me, Gary, we caught our limit in 20 minutes of rockfish. I said, Sean, again, you can't catch rockfish because there's nothing out there. He says, don't tell me that because there's lots of rockfish out there. So I can go on and on with this, but I'll just say that if you're going to take the fishing away from California, I want to know where the fish are coming from that's going to be in the stores selling fish, because, for an example, China is contaminating the world. You think the people blame the United States, but China is really bad. I want to be sure the fish that we eat is not going to be full of mercury and other toxic chemicals in the fish that are in these third world countries that are polluting the ocean back there. That's all I got to say. Thank you.
Thank you. One more? Claudia? McHare?
Hello. My name is Claudia McKeev, and I just recently got my master's at the University of Rhode Island studying fisheries economics, and specifically my thesis and research was on using marine reserves and MPAs as a fisheries management tool, so I thought I could just offer a minute or two of what I found and what my professors and I were working on. They can work. You just have to be very careful, and you can do it and design a marine reserve so that it can benefit the fishery, and you have to look specifically at the different species and the habitat, the size and the shape and the location that you're targeting. We found like a highly mobile species like tuna responded really a lot differently as compared to like a sea urchin. They liked like larger closures. I mean, we just looked for profits for the fishery and like finding that magic number that the fishermen are happy with, and the fish population levels were at a good, just sustainable, wonderful level. You ask for reasonable alternatives, and I can honestly say that quota systems work better, but you can also model an MPA system to emulate the quota systems, like the IHQ and the ITQ systems. So I just advise to look at the current scientific literature out there on bioeconomic modeling, and that MPAs can work, but just be very careful because it could go both ways. And that's all I have to say. Good luck.
Thank you. So that's it for speaker cards. I want to thank everybody again for coming. If you have additional comments you want to make, feel free to make them on the written cards in the back. And you can either leave those with us today or you can mail those in next week. Thanks a lot.